Thank you all for inviting me to be here. I appeared before you about a year ago, and we did a sermon on the subject of writing your obituary, what shall be said. And the sermon was kind of a opportunity to reflect on your biography interspersed with some humor. This is a trigger warning. There'll be no humor in today's remarks. Several years ago, Beverly and I after enjoying years of boating, satisfied an interest we had in transiting the Panama Canal. The canal was first conceived many years ago by Scottish engineers, and it was called the Darien Scheme. It was originally a project of the French, who turned the first shovelfuls of dirt, but eventually the project was turned over to the United States and was finished during the Teddy Roosevelt administration in 1914. Our trip through the 55-mile canal was an absolute delight. We enjoyed great weather, and we were mesmerized by the technical achievements that allow ocean-going vessels to transit between the Atlantic and the Pacific, the cities of Cologne and Panama City, in one day, saving them a trip that would otherwise take 2 weeks around the coast of South America. But if you're traveling north from South America by land from Colombia or further south, your passage through the Darien Gap, the southernmost portion of Panama, will be a much different ordeal than our delightful passage. This geographic region is known for its remoteness, difficult terrain, and extreme environment. Mosquito and disease-infested marshlands give way to largely impenetrable forest. No roads traverse the 66 miles of the gap to aid people traveling there, leaving only eroded paths and treacherous fjords across unpredictable waterways. Gangs of murderous thugs lie in wait to prey on people, often including families with young children, who are desperately fleeing violence and chaos in Haiti, Venezuela, or elsewhere, as they struggle to reach the promised land, the United States. In 2022, an estimated 250,000 people made this transit, and in 2023, the numbers increased to 520,000. These human beings constitute a tidal wave of humanity seeking a better life in the United States, a life many of us take for granted. The sacrifices they endure seeking a better life are beyond the imagination of many comfortably settled Americans. Last Monday, October 13th, Beverly and I attended the re-wedding of Akil and Rehan, an Afghan couple who made it to the United States by way of Pakistan, Germany, Brazil, the passage through the Darien Gap, Mexico, and the United States. The ceremony, which incidentally was officiated by Maxine Lautenberg, who's here with us today, was necessitated because they were seeking asylum and they were unable to produce a marriage certificate. So it was necessary for them to undergo this remarriage. And I felt an obligation to apologize to them on behalf of the American people for all of the hardship they had suffered. The story of people traversing the Darien Gap is a contemporaneous edition of the struggle of countless others seeking a life in the United States. Imagine the desperation and courage that pilgrims possessed in 1620 as they embarked on a tiny boat, the Mayflower, to cross the uncharted, tempestuous North Atlantic to escape religious intolerance. Or consider that between 1492 and 1930, 60 million Europeans migrated to the American continent. And between 1815 and 1930, what's been described as the largest migration in human history occurred when 42 million people settled in North America from Europe, their plight immortalized by Emma Lazarus. Lucy has just read you the poem from Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send us these homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The United States is, or was, indeed the shining city upon a hill, as Ronald Reagan described in his farewell address in 1989, he wrote, "In my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace, a city with free ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone and the will and the heart to get there." So is there any among us who isn't an immigrant or a descendant of one? But consider the current presidential view on immigrants. In 2015, when Trump announced his candidacy, he said of immigrants, "They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some I assume are good people." The rhetoric has continued and worsened. In October 2021, he said, "So we have hundreds of thousands of people from Haiti. Haiti has a tremendous AIDS problem. It's like a death wish for our country." And in December 2023, "I think the real number is 16 million people in our country. We've got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country." Blood poisoning appears in Mein Kampf by Hitler, criticizing race mixing. And then last year, Trump said, "No, they're not humans, they're animals." Trump's remarks seek to portray migrants as criminals. The ones we are getting are drug lords. We're getting gang members. They're rough people, in many cases from jails, prisons, mental institutions, insane asylums. You know, insane asylums, the Silence of the Lambs stuff, Hannibal Lecter. So what happened between the shining city on a hill with open doors and they're poisoning our people? The answers, surprisingly, are complicated. Consider that since the Reagan administration, there have been six presidents, three Republicans and three Democrats. Each served a total of 16 years. And during those 32 years, the annual rate of forced deportations has increased steadily, until last year, Barack Obama had the highest number of annual forced deportations, 370,000. At the present rate, the Trump administration is expected to deport 600,000 people in 2025. When I asked the men's breakfast group, which I go to for inspiration, how they would explain this shift in attitudes about immigrants, I immediately received two explanations: climate change and racism. So with this insight in mind, and with a little help from AI, the following analysis emerges. Climate change is a reason for this change in attitude toward immigrants, because as the world heats up, the U.S. becomes an even more desirable place to live economically, climatologically, and culturally. These advantages have increased the number of people fleeing bankrupt economies and nations riddled with corruption who seek admission to the United States. Climate change is a threat multiplier, making existing challenges such as poverty, food insecurity, and violence more virulent. This can be seen especially where prolonged drought in Central America forced whole populations to relocate north. Climate change was listed a number of years ago by the U.S. Department of Defense as the single factor causing unrest in the world and a threat to world peace. The second reason offered by my friend in the men's group was racism. The theory is that racism has never been obliterated in this country and has emerged recently because the contemporary culture, relaxed restraints that have kept racism under wraps, especially since the post Lyndon Johnson years of the civil rights. Our nation's efforts to accommodate racial differences have been speckled, to say the least. In the 19th century, Supreme Court cases like the Dred Scott decision and Plessy versus Ferguson legalized discrimination based on race, as did Korematsu versus U.S. in 1944, which upheld the internment of 175,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. More recently, however, the court has moved in favor of racial equality with key decisions such as Brown versus Board of Education, Loving versus Virginia, and Bateson versus Kentucky. And of course, we elected our first black president, a development which in the minds of many was a reach too far and became the pivot point in the struggle against racism. White lash was a consequence of Obama's election. Beginning as his first term in office and to a wholesale degree, in his second administration, Trump has taken steps that would have seemed unimaginable a short while ago. He has eradicated advancements made in the fights against climate change and racism. Other cultural attacks against diversity, equity, and inclusion have eviscerated carefully built protections for minority interests. The assault against these initiatives includes the disparagement and discrimination of minority groups and organizations, institutions of higher education, and political bodies, often in blatant disregard or outright defiance of settled law and principle. In this regard, note that the 32 nations that are subject to Trump's current travel restrictions are all in Africa. Also note that Trump's order to reinstate the former names of military bases with names of Confederate generals, some at the expense of black war heroes like Henry Johnson here in Albany. Racism and climate change are undoubtedly huge cultural stressors, standing alone, and their management, even at the hands of responsible national leaders, would create controversy. However, Trump's handling of these challenges serves a much different and more sinister purpose than of merely obtaining solutions to climate change and racial prejudice. A scrutiny of the evolution of the MAGA movement and an objective dissection of tactics used by Trump and others offers another explanation for his attack on minority groups, including immigrants. This explanation shows how pressures brought by climate change and racism can be turned to the advantage of unscrupulous persons bent on obtaining authoritarian political control. For authoritarianism to succeed, people must relinquish basic rights, and they do so because they are fearful of a real or imagined danger. Climate change causes scarcity, and immigrants and marginalized people represent perceived threats to these resources. Immigrants can be readily targeted as a threat, and their dehumanization at the hands of a demagogue is a ready avenue to enhance the power of the demagogue. Racism is also an easy target for scapegoating a marginalized group, especially given the cultural bias latently present in our society. Minorities, including immigrants, constitute groups that can be easily vilified and cast as a threat to resources and values we hold dear. Differences in physical appearances make racial discrimination especially easy and play to the us versus them scenario. Trump's incessant attacks on these groups, his repetition of cruel, vulgar, and dehumanizing remarks, objectifies targeted people, making them easy scapegoats and a handy resource that can be exploited for corrupt purposes. What is happening is a pretense. The call goes out that sacrificing basic rights is necessary to push back against minorities and immigrants who are dire threats to our way of life. In fact, what is really happening is that these groups are being scapegoated by unprincipled people. Think of the authors of the 2025 plan in their corrupt struggle to obtain dictatorial power. In an editorial remarking on the fact that the budget for ICE, which had been $3.4 billion for detention, will increase as a result of the big, beautiful bill to $45 billion, Patricia Lopez wrote, "Every sign here points to disaster in the makings of a police state." The antidote to this is resistance. Unrelenting, uncompromising, peaceful pushback. It's been estimated that when 3.5% of a population actively participates in protest, that is enough to ensure serious political change. I might, as an aside, point out that 7 million people protested last Saturday. That constitutes, I believe, about 1.5-2% of the American population. 3.5 would be 11 million. So we're getting there. But the protest must remain peaceful. Erica and Maria Chenoweth's research indicates that peaceful protests are twice as likely as violent protests to achieve change. Other than it be peaceful, the nature of protests can be as varied as circumstances permit. Demonstrations, letters to the editor, rapid response group, signs, even a polite statement of disagreement to a neighbor may create awareness that will bear fruit later. An especially useful way to push back is through support for the American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Civil Liberties Union, since it's the courts that have been the most steadfast opponents of Trump's illegal activities. Another way is to recognize the prominent place this church and this religion play as rallying points that stand in opposition to the forces of autocracy. Our religion rests on the bedrock principle that every human being has worth and deserves to be treated with decency and respect. Justice, the advancement of democratic principles, and a proper respect for science are values we cherish, yet these are the very concepts that are under attack. The moral dilemma being presented to us as a nation by the assault on these principles as an excuse to excoriate immigrants and minorities is no dilemma at all for people of our faith and for uncounted millions of others. For these many people, the proper response is resistance at all costs. Only then will demagogues among us be exposed and their true intent displayed for all to see. On Memorial Day 2024, the sanctuary in this church, this place we occupy right now, was dedicated in memory of Carter Lawson. Carter was a pacifist and actively opposed the war in Vietnam. He was given shelter in the UU Church in Buffalo. The dedication states that it is in recognition of the conscience, integrity, and sacrifice that Carter represented. I believe that all Unitarian congregations aspire to this standard and it is the degree of commitment called for by challenges being raised by the Trump administration. Blessed be.
Thank you, Eric.